give you just a sense of how fast things change in these two chapters, these 50-some hours, if you will. The front end of John 7 begins with the disciples urging Jesus to go up to the Festival of Tabernacles. Jesus doesn't want to go, and so his guys kind of get underway and they head towards the festival. A few short verses later, Jesus makes his way in secret to the temple, and less than a day and a half later, people are trying to stone him. So in a very short period of time, Jesus is kind of like with his guys, kind of by himself, and in a matter of a day and a half, he is going to be running for his life, for lack of a better expression, at the tail end of John 8. And we're going to kind of work through why this happens and the implications that it means for you and I here this morning. So just to give you a bit of a context, the Feast of Tabernacles, which is this big celebration that's happening in John 7, the Feast of Tabernacles is one of three festivals that the Jewish people were instructed to celebrate. And it would be like our Thanksgiving. Every fall in the Hebrew calendar, in the month of Tishri, they would gather together in the city of Jerusalem. Thousands of men and women from all over the country come together to celebrate God's provision, like we do at Thanksgiving. But not just thank you for corn and pumpkins and those things, but for the provision and deliverance that you have done way back in the Old Testament around the Exodus and Moses and leading them out of the land of Egypt. And this is this kind of moment. And this festival, I kind of use the expression of, like, if you're from the island, you know that kind of July 1st, like, the visitors come and the island swells in population. And it's like, we like to see them for a while and then we love to see them go, kind of thing. Like, this would be kind of what it is for Jerusalem, that this week, everyone comes from afar to celebrate. Every inn is full, restaurants are full, everything is just busy. But on day 8, when everybody leaves, it's like, thank you for your money, see ya next year. Like, it's that kind of spirit in the city. It's just very, 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 very busy. And it's in this context in which we read John 7 and 8. And we'll start with this moment where Jesus' own disciples try to trick him. They try the kind of Jedi mind trick. These are not the droid you're looking for. Like, he moves into space, and we read it right away in John 2, where we read, but when the Jewish Festival of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, here's the mind game, leave Galilee and go to Judea so that your disciples may see the works you do. No one who wants to become a public figure, like you want to become a public figure, acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world. Jesus, we know that you want to show yourself to the world, and you're never really to get on the main stage until you go to Jerusalem, until you go to New York City to be recognized. You're not going to get a big following if you remain in Tignish and just continue to do the tricks in Tignish kind of thing. If you're from Tignish, my apologies. Not a epicenter of activity. And this is what they are encouraging Jesus to do. Go to Jerusalem where you'll be known. Jesus' response to them is this, and I love how he is just smarter than all of them, us. He says, Jesus told them, this is in verse 8, my time has not yet come, but for you, any time will do. Like, you go because you're not unique and special like I am. Any time will do for you, but I need to wait because there's an appointed time by which I go. After he said this, he stayed in Galilee. After his brothers had left for the festival, he also went, not publicly, but in secret. And we kind of slip into John 7 in this moment where the disciples have gone ahead thinking that Jesus is not going. And after they're gone, Jesus quietly makes his way to New York, to Jerusalem, where the busyness is going to unfold. And over a period of 2 days, there is a distinct cycle that we see in John 7 and 8. We'll put the cycle up on the screen. This is what happens all the way through John 7 and 8. Jesus teaches. The crowd is absolutely kind of confused by who he is, and the tension rises around who Jesus Christ is. This is the cycle all the way through John chapter 7 and 8, once Jesus arrives in Jerusalem. The first cycle is in verses 14 to 32. And Jesus teaches, and it says this, not until halfway through the festival did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. After he was done teaching, here's the crowd's response. isn't this the man they're trying to kill? So they recognize that there's something about him that they're trying to kill him for. Have the authorities really concluded that he is the Messiah? But we know where this man is from. When Messiah comes, we will not know where he is from. Many in the crowds believed him. There is confusion around the man that is just taught in the temple courts on this particular day. And here's the tension. After this moment, the chief priests and the Pharisees sent temple guards to arrest him. Or, it says a little few verses later, they tried to seize him. Jesus arrives, he teaches. There's confusion around his identity, and they try to get him. The second cycle is a little bit further down, John 7, 37 to 44. Jesus teaches. He says, it says this, on the last and the greatest day of the festival, Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, "Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever drinks and kind of believes in me will not live in darkness." And there's this profound kind of teaching space in these verses. And the crowd's response to Jesus' words is this. On hearing his words, they say, "Surely this man is a prophet." Others say he is the Messiah. Still others ask, "Well, how can he be Messiah if he's from Galilee?" Can't be Messiah because Messiah comes from David's descendants. And the people were divided around who Jesus was. And after the confusion, we see the verse where it says, "And some wanted to seize him." So far, this is in the same day, two moments. Jesus says something. There's much confusion around his identity, and the guards try to get him. And then we go to the third cycle, which is in John 8, 2 to 12. And this is probably the one story that you actually know from John 7 and 8. This is the story of the woman who's caught in adultery, and she is brought before Jesus because they're trying to have her stoned. And there's this moment where through this scenario, Jesus teaches. He writes something in the sand beside her that we don't know what it is. He stands up and looks at those who are accusing her and says, "Okay, the one who doesn't have any sin, that has never made a mistake, you guys are allowed to throw the first stone." And because Jesus has just confronted their own reality of sin, they drop the rocks and they walk away. Jesus kneels down to this woman who, at this moment, I can't even begin to imagine the shame, the embarrassment, the guilt, the fear that she is experiencing because she has just been drugged from the act of adultery into this space where, remember, this is the crazy festival where everyone is watching. And Jesus kneels down and says to her, "No one is around anymore. No one is going to condemn you. Neither am I. Go and sin no more." The text doesn't say it, but make no mistake, there is much confusion around the identity of Jesus in this moment. If you are a regular person, a peasant Joe, if you will, and you watch this unfold, you walk away and you're aware that Jesus has just outed your religious leaders. That the men who control the world, as far as they know it, were not able to do what they wanted to do to her. And they walk away, basically, did this just happen? Did this man from Galilee authoritatively undermine and reveal a weakness, a fatal flaw in the code of the law? And it just creates confusion. And further that, the Pharisees, who their trick has been exposed, beating them nothing more than a trap, they would be mad, angry, because you have just been embarrassed as the leader who has no power and authority compared to this particular one. This cycle is here, and this tension continues to grow and build around who Jesus Christ is. So these are the three cycles. Jesus teaches, there's confusion in the crowd, and the tension rises around who he is. But so far in this story, in John 7 and 8, Jesus is kind of playing around with the leaders of the day, with people, on who he is. He hasn't been forthright about his identity. And give you some examples of what I mean. In John 7, it says, they were amazed at his teaching. And they ask him, "Where did you learn this?" And the response is, "Well, I learned it from the one who sent me." "Well, who's that guy? Like, who's that guy? Like, do I know him?" And Jesus doesn't kind of come right out and say who it is that sent him. It's just, "I learned it from the one who sent me." You figure out what I'm talking about. Then they go on and say, they ask, "Where is this man from?" And Jesus says, "You know where I'm from, but you don't know where I'm from." It's kind of this game, like, you know where I'm from, Mary, Joseph, Bethlehem, but I'm not from there. And it kind of leaves, like, well, yes, you are, but you're saying that you're from somewhere else. Like there's this kind of elusiveness around his identity. The other moment, where are you going? They ask him, and he responds, where I'm going, you cannot come. Well, why not? Is it fun? Like, why can't I go there? And Jesus says, well, where I'm going, you can't go there. Well, what's so unique about you that you're allowed the VIP pass, but I can't get there? Like, what is on going on here with who you are? And then Jesus, in this moment of teaching, says, whoever comes to me drinks rivers of life. I am the light of the world. Believe in me, and you'll never walk in darkness. This profound teaching moment, they say to Jesus, you just can't say these things. Your testimony is not valid. And Jesus' response is, oh, it's valid. It's valid. It's like that moment with your kids, like, I'm your dad. Like, whatever I have just said, it's valid. And if you don't get to your room, I'm going to show you how valid it really is. Kind of that tension. And Jesus responds, but he says, for I know where I came from and where I'm going, but you have no idea where I come from or where I'm going. Up till now, Jesus implies certain things about his origins and his identity, which is part of the reason why the people have such a hard time figuring him out. Where is he from? Who is this man? And I want to be fair to the crowds, because some of them actually are trying to sort this out. They are trying to sort out who this man is that is now on the scene in the big festival, lots of noise, lots of commotion going on. Who is this man? He has a power. He has an authority. He has the ability to stop a woman from being stoned. I want to know who he is. And they go through the list that they give him. Some said that he was a prophet. Some said that he was the Messiah. But even in that, they don't really know what Messiah actually means. Some say that he was from heaven. As we move to the back end of John 8, we see this like confusion around his identity growing, and the people they're not having it anymore. They want to know, who are you? And they ask him, we'll throw this is 8:25, John 8:25. This is the question that after all these moments, they force him, who are you? Stop with the games of you're going someplace that I can't go. Stop with the you know where I'm from, but you don't really know where I'm from. Wink, wink. Like, there's like, who are you? And this is where a great turn happens. When Jesus answers their question, they lose their mind. Let's work through this together. Put this up on the screen. And Jesus answers their question by chipping away at the two things that matter most to them as Jewish men and Jewish women. And you can read all of this in John 8, 31 to 59. And he chips away at their freedom, and he chips away at their heritage. Two big things that you and I also cling to. So when you read the scriptures, and some of us be like, ah, that's an old dated book, it really is not relevant. Listen, you are just a person like the first century Jewish man and woman. The difference is you just have an iPhone. Like, that's the only evolutionary process that makes us further ahead than them, is that you just have a phone. The same things that they struggle through, you struggle through, I struggle through. This is a part of the human condition, and Jesus chips away at these two things. And it's around freedom and heritage. So let's get into the whole Jesus goes after their heritage moment. They claim, we are Abraham's descendants. Jesus responds, I know that you're Abraham's biological descendants. It doesn't say biological, but he says, I know that you're Abraham's descendants. And yet, oddly enough, you're looking to kill me. Abraham, your father that you're claiming, he longed for my day. Your father, Abraham, would never be after my blood the way you are. And this is the turn. The reason why you want me dead is because of the desires of who your real father is, the devil. If that's not going to make you mad, I don't know what would. I can imagine me talking with Jesus. I am Norman Woodward's son. Yeah, you are. But your real dad is the devil. My dad's a bad guy sometimes, but like, come on. Like not that guy. Like, he takes a run at their heritage. And then Jesus goes after their freedom. They say to him, we have never been slaves to anyone. How can you say that you will set us free? Jesus' response is, everyone who sins is a slave to it. And if you're a slave to sin, you have no permanent place in my family. The only way you can experience this freedom is if you come to know the Son, and the Son sets you free. Jesus brings these two things, the heritage and freedom issues, he brings them together towards the very end, and it reads this way. This is Jesus saying it. John 8:44, it's up on the screen. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and is the father of lies. The reason they want Jesus dead is because they are a slave to sin. And those who are slaves to sin, regardless if your father's name is Norman, your real master is Satan himself. This is the moment where Jesus is no longer playing games with them. This is the moment where he no longer is using elusive language, talking about who they are, the conditions that they suffer in, and who he is, and how he can free them from this particular dilemma. After this encounter, they lose their minds towards him. We'll put it up on the screen. They ask him, "Are you greater than our father Abraham?" And you need to understand this. Abraham to them is the boss. Like, there is no one greater in their story other than Abraham, because this is the one in whom God, Yahweh, has chosen to be his special people. And by virtue of them being Jewish, we get all the benefits of being part of the family tree of our great father, Abraham. Are you greater than our father, Abraham? And then Jesus' answer is this: before Abraham was born, I am. In other words, before Abraham, the guy you know and cling to, I was around before him, because I'm God himself. I'm God himself. This is the coming out party of Jesus, clearly articulating who he is, his identity, and what he ultimately is going to do. There is no more confusion from John 8 on as to who Jesus thinks he is and who the crowds understand his claims to be. Jesus, in this moment, for the first time in John's gospel, clearly tells the world, I am God. In verse 59, this is the back end of these tense-filled 2 days, verse 59 of chapter 8, at this they picked up stones to stone him. And here's the point of it all. Jesus, during this festival, where they're celebrating God's provision and deliverance, has told them, and in the same breath he tells us, whatever you think you are, whoever you think you are, you need to know this above all things. We are all sinful, which means we are a slave to sin. And the reason why you're a slave to sin is because your real father is Satan himself. That kind of grates against the heart, doesn't it? Like, Jesus the Lord is saying, you're a sinner. You struggle with sin. And the reason why you do is because your real dad is Satan himself. The reason why I know this, not me, but if Jesus is saying, the reason why I know this is because I am God. I know everything. I see everything. I'm aware of everything. I lament the space that you're in, because it's not the space I have longed for you to be in. I know exactly what I'm talking about, because I'm God himself. And ever since Jesus utters these words, they go to work to kill him, and they will kill him in a few short weeks from this particular moment in John 8. And ever since this moment of Jesus' death and resurrection, our world has been at work trying to erase the words that Jesus spoke about who he is, that he is God. We go to work all the time to remove his divinity, to remove the fact that he is God. We do it all the time in our culture. Our culture is incredible at it. We don't necessarily claim that Abraham is our father, because we are Westerners. We are ignorant in our individuality. We are stubborn. We are people who are masters of our own demise. Some of us hate the idea of who our biological father is, and we set our own course. We are our own masters. We are our own kings and queens, and no one tells me what to do but me. And then Jesus comes in and says, yeah, you think that way, but you're a slave to your real father, and your real father is the evil one. Have a great day. Like, it's kind of that awkward space of him revealing who we are, but he doesn't leave us in this space. He doesn't leave us in this vulnerable moment, if we will be truthful with ourselves, of the problem that he now reveals before us. We in our culture, we remove the divinity of Jesus Christ, his claims, by simply saying, I can get around the idea that he was a real guy, like that he lived in the first century. I can even get around the idea that he was a prophetic messenger as it relates to social issues. In fact, that's one of the reasons why people like Jesus so much. He was for the feeding of the widows. He was for feeding of the poor. He was for caring for the outcast and the outsider. He was against the religious systems that keep people in oppression. And this is why people like him so much, even who don't know him or will never agree that he was God. They just think he was a great social change agent. Others will argue that he was simply a great moral voice. He had good values. Let's follow Jesus because he had some good values to share with us. He was a charismatic leader. He was a philosopher, and we banter around his ideas in universities to this day. We create all kinds of other headings for him, but we do not like the idea that he is in fact God himself. We want to keep him as being just a carpenter's son. We want him to be the guy that comes to our house, does the reno, fixes the chair, shares some good moral advice, and then leaves. We do not like the idea of this being the Lord himself that's entered our space to tell us something that's very true of our lives that then he can also free us from and fix us from. Jesus, knowing that as human beings, we will struggle with the idea that a carpenter has just claimed to be God, because let's be honest, there's been lots of them through the years. There's been lots of people. It is not unique to Jesus that he, as a man, said, I'm God. On a weird level, most men think that way. And the women laugh. And the men are like, so? Like, we struggle with this. But there have been other men who have been living on the planet over the last 2,000 years that claimed to be Jesus, that claimed to be God. This is not unique to the person of Jesus Christ. And what's odd about a lot of these individuals, they prove themselves to be nothing more than kind of crazy Uncle Tom. Like, he arrives, he makes some ridiculous claims about life or whatever the case might be, and then they die, never to be heard from again. Jesus is different. And this is the thing, and I need you to hear this, this is the thing that makes Christian faith distinct and different from all other spiritualities on the planet. Our figurehead, Jesus Christ, claimed to be God. And then he goes that extra mile to say, listen, and I'm going to prove it to you. I'm going to prove it to you. You say, well, what did he say to prove it? Well, it's in John chapter 8, verse 28. We'll put up on the screen. Jesus says this, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I'm he. When you crucify me, is what he's referencing. On this day, you will know that I am God. On this day. What makes Jesus' claim of God stand out against all other people who have claimed to be God? Jesus is the only one who was killed, and listen, and got back up from the dead again. He's the only one. And you're like, I can't believe that. I can't believe that he was killed and he was buried and then he got up from the grave again. I believe that he was a real man. I believe that he said some good things. I believe that he may have even been a miracle worker and did some crazy things like walk on water. But to tell me that he died and was buried and then he got up again, that's just foolish. That defies all logic. Yes. Yes, it does. And yet, there is a ton of evidence that speaks to his resurrection. I'm going to throw this up on the screen. How many of you like to read? All right. This is a book I would encourage you to buy and read. It's 90 pages long. I am not a strong reader, and I've read it a lot of times. It pares down the final days of Jesus' life, and it unpacks the days that immediately followed the resurrection from a historical context and walks through eight different, profoundly solid, empirical evidences of the resurrection. And if you buy it and read it, you might even think, man, this sounds like Phil's sermon last Easter. Yes. And the year before, yes. Like eight Easter Sunday mornings in a row have come from this book right here, because it profoundly walks through the evidences around the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Because without the resurrection, this is the greatest game on the world. Like, you are wasting time. I'm wasting time. We are just buffoons without the resurrection. The resurrection is what separates Christian faith from all other faith, because our King was killed and got back up from the grave again as evidence to the claim, I am God. I am God. And when one comes to that place by faith of believing that this is true, that Jesus Christ, the one who lived 2,000 years ago, is God, sent by God, for his glory, for my joy, for life, for all these things, and we respond to him by faith, the father of lies, the evil one, Satan himself, in your life, he has his wings clipped. He loses his ability to control you in this moment when you acknowledge Christ by faith. And I am moved by God's grace from the heritage of the evil one, the family tree that I find myself in over here. I am moved from here into the family tree of my Savior, Christ himself, where I become a son of the living God, where I experience a freedom. And here is the place that I need you to hear me. A lot of us who've grown up in Atlanta, Canada, or Canada, United States, doesn't matter, over the last 50 years, this is where the good news ends. Believe Jesus Christ, Son of God, died, was raised, say a prayer, and you're good. And that's all true. But there's one other part that we have just miserably failed in our context and culture over the last 50 years. How do I know this? Because My parents' generation is the most unchurched generation that there ever was on the planet. All of them, and when I say all of them, in Atlantic Canada in 1970, 93% of people were in some form of Christian education, and the overwhelming majority of them at some point made some kind of decision of faith around who Jesus Christ is. 93% of people. I think we're like at 15% now in Atlanta, Canada. Where did everybody go? Where are the people that have declared that Christ is King when they were 10? And as they grow older, my dad's ministry in his last few years of his life was hired by a church, work in a village of Hillsborough, and go find all the men who made decisions when they were 10 who are nowhere to be seen, whose lives are a train wreck in every way. That was his job. And he did great at it. To go find them and figure out what had happened. And the issue was ultimately, if I can pare it all down, is God failed them. They signed up for something that when cancer came, when sickness came, when divorce came, when something awful came and it touched their life, they had no idea how to navigate through it, and they were promised that these things wouldn't happen to them. And they left. God failed them in the end. And the reason why we have this perspective is because we don't go all the way with the good news of Christ. And Jesus takes us all the way in John chapter 8, because he promises a freedom. If you come to know the Son will set you free. Well, what does that look like? I'm about freedom. I want to experience life. I want to experience joy. What is this connected to? Well, the verses that we never read sound just like this. It's up on the screen, 8:31 and 32. And I've highlighted the words that matter. If, this is the little trick, if you read the scriptures, if whenever you see an if then, pay close attention to the if then. If you hold to my teaching, not to earn anything, not to earn God's favor, not to gain blessing, not to leverage your obedience for him later. If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciple, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Many people have come to the place of acknowledging Christ to be God. Many people have come to this intellectual space of, yeah, I can believe by faith that Jesus lived, died, was raised from the grave, and it ends there for them. And in their life have experienced nothing but turmoil and not at all the freedom that Christ promises and offers through his words to us. Jesus goes all the way, if you hold to my teaching, then and only then will you experience freedom in this life and great joy in your death. My question to you before we bring our service to a close is really this. How many of you want to be free? And not, and this word is kind of polluted because of the country we live in, not like Canadian freedom and American freedom, which is actually slavery on a whole bunch of levels. How many of you want to be free? That regardless of what government policies are passed, that regardless of what your workplace does, that regardless of what happens in your life, there is a freedom that you experience that is just, it's hard to explain, that these things no longer have any bearing on your life. This is what Christ offers. And if you follow me, the Son will set you free. How many of you want to be free? If the answer is yes, his words lead you there. And it all hangs in the balance by following Jesus' instruction. Let's watch the screen, and Dana and crew are going to come back and lead us in a song.
Who is Jesus?
That's the question.
That's the question.
Was he a real person?
What did he say?
What did he do?
What made him so special?
What made him different than any other man in history?
The records show.
His birth was a miracle.
His mom was a virgin and she was pregnant.
He made the blind see.
The deaf hear.
The mute speak.
The paralyzed walk.
He healed terrible diseases.
He knew what was in men's minds.
He knew what was in men's hearts.
He knows what is in men's hearts.
He knew the story of people's lives without ever having met them.
He spoke with authority.
He amazed teachers.
He amazed everyone.
Nature obeyed him.
He turned water into wine.
He walked on water.
He walked on top of the water.
He could change the weather.
He fed 5,000 people from one lunchbox.
He brought people who were dead back to life.
He loved sinners.
He loved everyone.
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 He forgave sins.
He never made a mistake.
He never once sinned.
But we judged him.
We whipped and beat him.
We spit on him.
And we killed him.
He loved us anyway.
He loves us anyway.
He died for us.
He died so that we wouldn't have to.
He paid for our sins with his life.
Did I mention he loves us?
He came back to life.
He was dead.
Then he was alive.
A lot of people saw him.
He is coming back.
Who is Jesus?
That's a big question.
That's the big question.
What does it even matter?
What does it matter to you?
Who is Jesus?
My answer doesn't matter to you.
Only your answer matters to you.
Who do you say that he is?
Who do you say that he is?